Remember, so far, we defined what we mean by a continuous manifold, by introducing the notion of topological space. We were able to define the notion of continuity. Then we introduced charts. And today we could use to define the notion of differentiability. Because when we change chart, we end up with a map from Rn into Rn, and we know what differentiability there means. So we use that notion to define the notion of differentiability also for a manifold. Now, the task is to define the notion of direction. And mathematically, that will be the notion of tangent vector. It's pointing somewhere at every point, pointing somewhere. But how do we do that? These manifolds have initially no such structure. It's just a set of points. We know about their continuity, we know about their differentiability of the manifold, but how do we describe at every point the possible directions in which something can point? How do we define tangent vectors? And we started discussing last time that there are three popular definitions, all a little different from another, but equivalent ultimately. We'll start with the most difficult notion of tangent space, the algebraically defined notion of tangent space, but we will also do the geometric and the physicist's definition. So let's begin in this way. Here's the differentiable manifold M, and here's a region around the point P, some open set around the point P, let's say, and we have a chart which maps all points in that region into points of Rn. In this way, the chart gives a name to the points in here. Each point, which is otherwise nameless, now acquires the name of a point in Rn that it's being mapped to, and that name is, of course, a set of n numbers, an n tuple, the n coordinates of that point. What we'd like to do is similarly to define for a point P, and for any arbitrary point P, of course, but let's say we hold some point P fixed, we would like to define the tangent space on that point, and we would like to have a map from that tangent space into, well, something similar to this, where we map into Rn, for example, so that every vector in a tangent space again acquires a name, which hopefully will be an n-tuple. How can we do this? How can we define directions on a manifold and tangent vectors? So how do we define the tangent space, which will be called T index P of M? So it's just the tangent space at a particular point, P. The intuition is, of course, that this is some kind of flat thing that's attached to an otherwise bent manifold. But remember, we have not yet introduced any structure that would describe the shape of a manifold. But shape or not, there should be a notion of direction. There should be a set of possible directions, a set of possible velocities you could travel onwards from that point P, for example. So whichever way we define it, we expect that an n-dimensional manifold has at every point some n-dimensional vector space of tangent vectors. The three ultimately equivalent definitions of the tangent space of the manifold at the point P are the algebraic definition, the physicist definition, and the geometric. And very briefly, before we actually go into the algebraic definition, a quick overview again. Algebraic definition, which is by far the most abstract and most powerful, it even goes beyond ordinary geometry. You can use that also, for example, for non-commutative geometry, or to define directions for objects that simply are not geometric at all. So the algebraic definition has as its basic idea that directions are in one-to-one correspondence to directional derivatives. Now you might think, but how is that an advance? How does that help us? We don't know how to define directions. We don't know how to define directional derivatives either. So that doesn't make it easier. But here's the thing. We would like some mathematical way to capture the notion of direction. But we already have a mathematical way to capture the notion of derivative. Derivatives can be recognized by their properties. Derivatives can be recognized by the fact that they obey the Leibniz rule. So, you know, when you have an operation, let's call it prime, and we have fg prime is equal to f prime g plus fg prime. And you can pretty much nail down what differentiation is just from that. You don't have to go back to the Newton-Leibniz definition of taking a limit and so on. This property contains already the essence of differentiation. So the idea is that if what we are after is directions, tangent vectors, directions, let's see if we can pin down what directional derivatives are. And then the directional derivatives, we can identify with the directions, with the tangent vectors. And directional derivatives, we can pin down because they obey something like this. The derivative in the x direction, for example, if you choose a coordinate system, the derivative in the x direction will obey that. If this prime is considered to be the differentiation in the x direction, the same will be true for y direction and z direction. So you can recognize the operation of differentiation by it obeying a Leibniz rule. And any linear combination of differentiating in the x, y, or z direction, so any directional derivative will also obey the Leibniz rule. So the idea is to identify directional derivatives by their property of obeying the Leibniz rule, and then make an identification and say, okay, here I have my set of directional derivatives. They are, per definition, in one-to-one correspondence to what I mean by directions or tangent vectors. So tangent vectors will be identified with directional derivatives identified in this way. And you see, the Leibniz rule doesn't contain any limit taking or anything of that kind. It's an algebraic operation. And that is what makes this definition so powerful. It can be used even on structures that are no manifolds in any way. For example, so-called non-commutative geometries. You can still define derivatives as operations that obey a Leibniz rule or maybe a modified Leibniz rule, and in this week, tangent spaces and so on. Well, after that, we will cover the physicist's definition of tangent spaces, which is to say that the elements of a tangent space at a point are all those mathematical structures which behave in a particular way under change of charge. You know from special relativity that objects with one upper index transform in such a way under Lorentz transformation, those with a lower index in this way under Lorentz transformations, and so on. And in this way, you identify tangent and cotangent vectors, contravariant and covariant vectors. That would be the definition that Einstein used. And then there's the geometric definition, where we say directions or tangent vectors ought to be in one-to-one correspondence with paths through our point P. They can go in different directions, and the tangents to paths should be the tangents to the point. So the tangents, if P is the point to which we want to know what the tangent vectors are, let us consider all paths that pass through P and consider their tangent vectors at a point, and they ought to be tangent vectors of the manifold at that point. So as we mentioned before, the three definitions are ultimately equivalent, but they have different uses. So we'll use all of them occasionally, as the case may be. Let's start with the algebraic definition. So So the idea is, as we mentioned, the tangent vector is identified with a directional derivative. And directional derivatives can be identified as operations that obey a Leibniz rule. Let us look at a simple example. Simple example is that of the differentiable manifold, which is given by Rn itself. Now, the tangent vectors at a point P shall be denoted by a vector xi, for example. So if xi is a tangent vector to a point P, then we are identifying here this tangent vector with a directional derivative in this way. Xi is the abstract tangent vector, but it is defined to be this linear combination of partial derivatives. So in particular, if, let's say, xi is an n tuple of n numbers, and they are 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and so on, then what we have is xi is simply d by dx1 at the point in question. Remember, we are always picking, so far, we're just picking a point to the manifold, and we are interested in the tangent space to that particular point. So xi, to be completely accurate, you should have an index pi, an index p here, because it's a tangent vector to the point p of the manifold. Okay, so if only one of those xi is non-zero, then we have only one of those derivatives. And then literally, xi is just a derivative in a particular direction. Let's say in the x1 direction or something like that. But we can choose any direction we want, and we can choose different weights for any one of those directions. So all possible directions that we could possibly differentiate in, all the possible directional derivatives correspond to a tangent vector by definition. This is not something we have to prove, it's just a definition. We call all those expressions xi tangent vectors. So a tangent vector, you shouldn't think of as an arrow. A tangent vector, you should think of as a map. A tangent vector is, after all, a derivative at a point. So a tangent vector at the point P feeds on functions. It eats up a function, it differentiates it to obtain this number here, xi of f, right? So you take, this is xi, the tangent vector, it eats a function, and it gives you the directional derivative of that function in this direction, evaluated at a point, which is a number. So tangent vectors are taking in functions and spitting out numbers. It's not completely accurate. I will get to the subtleties of this in a moment. But it's important to notice that tangent vectors defined in this exact way, tangent vectors obey the Leibniz rule. If you take a tangent vector, and remember that's just this, and you feed it two functions, then you get that it is the action of the tangent vector on the first function times the second function plus the first function times the action of the tangent vector on the second function. So number, the whole thing is a number again. The slight inaccuracy that we had in what I just said is that xi doesn't really, we have to look exactly at what we feed the xi. You see, xi only knows the function at the point P, right? I mean, it doesn't care what the function does anywhere else on the manifold. So what exactly do we feed the xi there? It's what is called a function germ. But we'll get to that in a moment. So the point is that I wanted to show you here that if we define tangent vectors as directional derivatives at the point in question, then these tangent vectors will obey a Leibniz rule. Easy to see if you choose your xi to point into one direction here. Let's say the d by, it's just d by dx1. then obviously this is just d by dx1 applied to these two functions, and you get the Leibniz rule. But it's true also if you take two of them by the linearity of it, if you just work it out. So all directional derivatives, not just the ones that point into the coordinate directions, obey the Leibniz rule. So what we've seen here is that if we define them like that, then they will obey the Leibniz rule. Okay, now let's ask, how do we express the local nature of the tangent vectors appropriately? You see, the tangent vectors live in the tangent space to a particular point P. And I said, loosely speaking, that they feed on the function, the functions at the point P. But not quite. You see, what are these functions at the point P? At the point P, these functions take values. So the function f at the point P is a number. The function g at the point P is a number. And if we differentiate any number, we get zero. That's not what we did. So our derivative, our directional derivative psi, our tangent vectors, act on a little bit more than just the functions evaluated at the point P. They definitely don't need as their input all of the functions defined on all of the manifold. We don't need to know what the function does elsewhere to figure out what the directional derivative is at a particular point. So what is it then? At one point alone, it's not sufficient to know the function to calculate the directional derivative. But we also don't need to know what the function is at any other point at P. So what are these tangent vectors acting on? Turns out that what these tangent vectors are acting on are so-called function germs, not functions. So what are function germs? Let's do the definition in quite some generality, and then we specialize it to the case that we need for the moment. Imagine that M and N are differentiable manifolds, and P is a point in the first manifold in M. Now we look at two maps. We look at two maps or functions from M into N. Map or function is the same thing. So we're looking at two functions, phi and psi. Both of them map from M into N. In principle, they could be arbitrary functions. But we will call them germ equivalent if they do the exact same thing in a neighborhood of P. Okay, so we say that two functions, phi and psi, from M to N, are germ equivalent at the point P in question if the two functions do the exact same thing in some neighborhood, in some open neighborhood of our point P. So if U is a neighborhood of is a subset of M, which is a neighborhood of the point P, and we have that phi of Q is psi of Q for all points Q which are in that neighborhood. So if phi and psi map a neighborhood of P in exactly the same way to N, then we say that the two maps phi and psi are germ equivalent at P. In other words, these functions are the same function in some neighborhood. And so now you can take all functions from M into N, and you pick a point in M, and you can ask, which functions are germ equivalent there? And first of all, you can check that this is an equivalence relation. If the function phi and the function psi are germ equivalent at P, so they agree on a neighborhood of P, and another function theta is germ equivalent to psi, So that means that psi and theta agree in an open neighborhood of P, and phi and psi agree in an open neighborhood of P. Well, then also phi and theta will agree on that open open neighborhood, namely the intersection of the two. So it's an equivalence relation. And so that means that all of these functions from M to N can be put into germ equivalence classes. If you start with one of those functions, then you can look at all of the other functions that are germ equivalent to it. And then you take another function and you look at all the functions that are germ equivalent to that one, etc. So your entire function space breaks up into a space of germ equivalent, into germ equivalence classes. They are also called simply germs at P, or function germs at P. And these neighborhoods on which they agree the two germ equivalent functions can be arbitrarily small. But you see, this is what ultimately matters for the tension spaces, because you need a little bit more than just, you know, the function value at a point. In order to evaluate the derivative, you need to have it a tiny little bit away from that point, some neighborhood. It could be arbitrarily small, but you need it on a neighborhood. And all functions that are equivalent on a neighborhood will do exactly the same as far as directional derivatives are concerned, and that's why that definition is appropriate. So this is just a short, the bare bones mathematical notation that psi is in the germ equivalence class of the function phi. The germ equivalence class, the function phi for the point P, and germ equivalence class will be denoted by putting a bar over a function. So we take a function, and then it generates an entire germ equivalence class, a set of all those functions that are germ equivalent to it that agree with it on some neighborhood, and that germ equivalence class generated by a function phi will be called phi bar. And psi is in that germ equivalence class if there exists an open neighborhood of the point P, such that for all points in that neighborhood, we have that the two functions agree, that psi agrees with what phi does. So it's just the language-independent way of writing these things. See, it's a bit like Chinese characters or so, right? You don't need to know the language necessarily to be able to read them. Wouldn't it be nice if all of math could be expressed in just characters like this? I don't know if there was a symbol for conjecture or something like that. Anyway. Okay. So now assume that phi is a differentiable map from a manifold, from a differentiable manifold M into a differentiable manifold N. Then it's clear that all the functions psi in that same equivalence class will possess the same first derivative. So let's consider now a special case that will be important for us, namely where the second differentiable manifold N, you see up here, we are considering maps from, oh, how far do I have to scroll? Oh my God. What? Sorry about that. Okay, so we were looking at differentiable maps. Yeah, well, from M to N. And we kept here the capital N, an arbitrary differentiable manifold, but we can choose it to be R, just the real numbers, the real number line. And that is a special case that is, like here. That is a special case that will be important. Yes?
Yes, so for this, will all the derivatives not be equal at the point P?
Well, what you do if you have a function that perhaps has a jump at a point, at the point P? It may not even be differentiable there. right? And it too will generate a function germ. We may not want to consider these functions, but I'm just saying you could have a function which, let's say, has, you can twice differentiate it, but not three times. And then that will generate a function germ with the same properties. Okay, so, right. Now, let us look at, where were we? Right. Now we say, we look at a special case, namely the germs of scalar functions, of functions that go from a differentiable manifold into this manifold being simply the real line. So the functions are mapping the differentiable manifold into R. And in particular, they map P. For every point on the manifold gets mapped into some real number. So how then do we specify a germ? Well, it suffices to specify one element of a germ equivalence class, and then all other elements of the germ equivalence class can be generated from that. So you give just one function, and then in principle you know already the entire germ equivalence class. And the set of all those germ equivalence classes, or in short, the set of all those function germs at the point P, is denoted F of P. And what you see is it's not exactly a function space, right? It's an equivalence class. It's a space of an equivalence class of functions. However, it almost behaves the same way as a space of functions. In particular, we have these nice properties of function germs. So remember, when you take a function and you put a bar over it, then you denote the germ equivalence class generated by that function at the point P. So let's assume C is some real number, and F and G are function germs. F bar and G bar are function germs. So F is a function generating a function germ with a bar on top of it, and that would be an element of F of P, and G as well is some function. If you put a bar on it, it's a germ equivalence class, and it lives in that space of germs. Then the claims are, and we don't have time to prove such things, but it's not difficult, are that if you take a function and multiply it with a constant, some number, and then take the gauge, not the gauge, the germ equivalence class of it, then this is the same as if you first form the germ equivalence class and then multiply those with a number. Similarly, if you take two functions, then you can multiply them and form the germ equivalence class, or first form the germ equivalence classes and multiply, same thing. And all of that is true because they are the same. On some neighborhood, they are always the same. Yes?
So this is only true for R, right? So
yes.
If we live in Rn, then C can be a matrix.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. No, this is just for R now. We're mapping from M into R.
Aren't these just definitions of the right-hand side?
Yeah, in a way you can say it's a definition of it. That's right. It's almost tautological. Now, what this means is that the space of function germs, F of P, obeys the axioms of an associative algebra. So we can add function germs, we can multiply function germs, and all of that is simply induced by multiplying or adding functions that generate the function germs. And the only non-trivial thing to check here is whether this is a consistent definition. So now we are ready to finally define the tangent space to a manifold M at a point P. It's So the elements of the tangent space, that was the general idea, are to be first derivatives. And first derivatives are to be recognized, are to be identified as mathematical operations that obey this Leibniz rule over there. So now we define the tangent space on the manifold M at the point P to be the set of so-called derivations of the algebra of function germs. So we have the associative algebra of function germs. Are you all clear about what an associative algebra is? You see, physicists sometimes use the word algebra for two different things. For the term associative algebra, but some physicists are in such a hurry, they will even express Lie algebras as algebras, because they don't have time for the word Lie. But these two things are totally different. A Lie algebra obeys completely different axioms from an associative algebra. So an associative algebra has a commutative addition, a multiplication operation that doesn't have to be commutative, but that has to be associative. And then there have to be distributive laws between them. And the whole thing is also a vector space. Technically, it's a ring over a field. And Lie algebras are very different things. We will get to Lie algebras later on. Anyway, if you're not completely sure about the definition of an associative algebra, I very much recommend that you just look up the axioms and have a quick look. Okay, so our set of germ equivalence classes at the point P has the properties of an algebra. We can add germ equivalence classes, we can multiply germ equivalence classes, multiply them with numbers, and all of these definitions are consistent and obey the axioms of an associative algebra. And now we're looking at the so-called derivations of this algebra. That's a kind of thing that we will do quite a bit in this course. Consider an algebra, not just this one, but also other algebras. Consider an algebra, and then consider the set of derivations of that algebra. And a derivation of an associative algebra is a linear map from the algebra into the real numbers, such that when you apply that derivation onto the product of two of these elements, two of the elements of FP, then you get this, which is the Leibniz rule. Okay, so we define a derivation of the associative algebra to be any map, any linear map, that takes as its input an element of the germ equivalence classes, so one of the germs, and outputs a number in such a way that when applied to the product of two, we get this. And that's just in a more accurate way what we said earlier. Directional derivatives obey the Leibniz rule. It's clear for differentiating in a particular direction, like the x direction or the y direction, or any linear combination of them. But this doesn't refer to a coordinate system at all. This doesn't refer to any chart. It's a completely abstract definition. And you can imagine doing such a thing for algebras that are very different from algebras of germs of functions at the point P for a differentiable manifold M. You could have some non-commutative algebra, for example, which definitely cannot be the algebra of functions, of number-valued functions. And then you can ask for derivations of those. And then you get into non-commutative geometry. Now, let's be completely accurate about these things. So the derivation takes as input a function germ, outputs a number in the following way. with this property, you apply the derivation to the product of two function germs. And remember, that's defined by taking a member of the first function germ, some function that generates that function germ, a member of the second function germ, some function G that generates it, and then multiply them, and that gives you a function which generates a function germ. That's what you do here on the left-hand side. And that's what the xi is acting on. And then that gives you a number, because these guys map into the real numbers. The xi map into the real numbers, the directional derivative of that function germ at that point. And that's the same as what you get when you take the derivation acting on that function germ times, now this is a function germ, and it is at the point P, which is to say that you evaluate this function germ at the point P, and all members of that equivalence class take the same value because they agree actually on the neighborhood. And so that is actually just a number here. And similarly here, that is a number, because if you just evaluate a function germ at the point in question, then they all agree, and that is that number then. So there they have a unique value. So you can drop that bar here. It's the same thing at that point there. And I mean, this is the number you get, and here is the derivation again acting on a function germ. Now, so that was quite a leap here, because it's totally abstract. We're looking at the differentiable manifold. We didn't even consider any charts. Everything is without, we don't have a handle on these things with numbers yet. We just point to a sketch on of a manifold. We point to a point P, and then we say, yeah, we do this, we do that. But we haven't really mapped that into our N in any way yet, so that we would have a handle on it and give names to these things. We still have to do that. This is totally abstract.
Mm-hmm. When you define it like this, then the tangent vector can act on functions that are discontinuous at the point, but when you define them as directional derivatives, then they can't, right?
So then I don't see that they're exactly the same.
Well, we will not allow for the function germs to contain or be generated by functions that are not differentiable. We will always work with the differentiable functions. Okay. It would mess things up if we...
In that case, why don't we just define... I think the definition of a function germ is too much then. Can't we just define a function germ to be the equivalence class of functions that have the same... that are the same value and the same derivative?
Yeah.
Instead of overall whole...
Yes, and ultimately it will boil down to that. Because ultimately we will expand all of this. We will not just keep being tied down to a particular point P. And then we will free ourselves from that and look at the whole thing, at bundles over the of that manifold and so on. And then eventually it will boil down to that. But for now, just to be careful, this is what these derivations are acting on. We will sometimes introduce concepts that are a little bit more general than we will actually need. So this definition is abstract enough, not only for arbitrary differentiable manifolds, but as I already indicated, to define tangent vectors in this way is as derivations of an algebra, so as linear maps that obey a Leibniz rule. This thing often also works when the algebra in question is non-commutative. Now you may wonder, what's the big deal with going from commutative algebras to non-commutative algebras? Well, the big deal is that we have one example of going from a commutative to a non-commutative algebra that changed the world. We started with a commutative phase space and ended up with quantum mechanics, which is basically a non-commutative phase space, where the functions on the phase space of X and P become non-commutative. And there is an effort underway to generalize that, to say that, well, maybe the positions among themselves are non-commutative. Or maybe there are corrections to the XP commutation relations. Maybe the P's are not commutative. In fact, in a way, the P, the momentum operators, the generators of translations, are not commutative. On curved space, they are not. Parallel transport is not commutative on curved manifolds, as we will see. Anyway, so non-commutativity is associated both with quantization and with curvature. So it is generally of interest to have concepts that work for commutative algebras generalized so that they work also for non-commutative algebras. In which case, Newton's notion of derivatives doesn't work, but the notion of derivation can still work. All right, let's look at a constant function, a simple example here. A constant function c, and its germ c bar, which is the set of all those functions that agree with the function c, which is constant in some neighborhood of p. So c of x, where x are the points in the manifold, is just the constant number c in R. Then a simple proposition is that if you apply one of those derivations on c bar, on that, if you feed it that function germ, then it has to be mapped into zero, which is intuitively what you would expect. The directional derivative of a constant function better be zero in all directions. So for all xi, remember the xi are supposed to be in one-to-one correspondence with the directional derivatives. Any one of those directional derivatives applied to a constant function has to give zero. But we cannot appeal here to intuition. We have to prove this from the way we set things up. So let's see. We can apply xi to c bar, the germ of the function c. And by the linearity that we had earlier, we can pull the c out. And then the 1 is, of course, the germ equivalence class of functions that in some neighborhood of the point p are 1. So I could write a bar over here, but at some point that gets too tedious. And 1 is 1 times 1, again with 2 bars, if you like. But because the Leibniz rule is obeyed, the application of this derivation on this product of 2 elements gives us the application of xi on the first element multiplied with the second evaluated at the point, plus the other way around. And that just gives us 2c xi of 1. But if that's the case, then we have that, if you just subtract that, we get that c times xi of 1 is 0. So we get that xi of c bar is 0. So we can prove simple things like that, even without intuition, just from the axioms. Now, let's look at the case where we map into Rn. So that could be, for example, a chart. We are mapping now, this is M. So the manifold that we work with is Rn, and we are mapping Rn into R. So we are looking at functions from Rn into R. If our definition for the tangent space is as good as promised, then we expect that, as promised, these derivations of an algebra of function germs really are the directional derivatives. We didn't set it up this way, but in the case where the manifold is Rn, we better get that, because that was the whole idea of it. So we want to check whether the derivations on the algebra of function germs at the point p are really always of the form of a directional derivative. It's relatively easy to check that any directional derivative is a derivation of the algebra. You just have to check whether Leibniz rule holds for that when applied to a function germ. But that's not the direction we go. I mean, that's another one direction we want to go, but it's easy. The more difficult one is assume we know of Xi only that it is a derivation of the algebra of germs. How do we know that it can be written in this way? Maybe we get the function, I mean, just at, to play devil's advocate here, it could be that our derivations include the directional derivatives, but include also way more stuff that we didn't intend to cover. That could happen too. So surely these things are derivations, because, yeah, Leibniz rule holds, but are all derivations of that form. Now that's a little tedious, but let's go through this quickly. And if you get a little bit lost with the details, you can always look that up later in the notes. So we choose P to have coordinates 0, 0, 0, 0 for simplicity. You can always choose that without restricting generality. We choose one of those derivations. So remember, TP of M is defined as the set of derivations of the algebra of function germs at P. And we choose some function germ. We also introduce a notation that we will use throughout the course, and which was probably introduced by Einstein. Einstein definitely used it. I don't know of anybody using it earlier. I think it was used earlier. In any case, it's a notation that is widespread in differential geometry. Namely, if you differentiate a function with respect to some variable, and you have your variables enumerated from 1 to n, and you differentiate with respect to the ith variable, then you can indicate that by taking the function and just putting there a comma and I. So take the function, comma I means take the partial derivative in the direction of the ith variable. I mean, just differentiate with respect to the ith variable. It just saves a little bit of notation. Okay, so then we start with this derivation that we chose and the function germ that we chose. And we write it in this way. We write it as the derivation of this. So we've added and we subtracted something, where this is the function f, and we take the germ of it. This is the function f evaluated at the point 0, which is the point p that we're interested in. Therefore, it's a number. And we are considering the function germ of that constant function, and here too. So this then is the derivation of this, where we've just carried that forward. We've put the bar over the whole thing, and then we have f of x minus f of 0. But f of x minus f of 0 can be written by the fundamental theorem of calculus as the integral from 0 to 1 of the derivative of this function here. It's a trivial thing. Just forget about the bars for a moment, because they will be just over everything. And inside those bars, just for the functions themselves, you can always write the integral from you can always write f of x minus f of 0 as the integral over the derivative of f, running that path from 0 to x. And then because of linearity, you can pull this bar in here. Then in the next line, we use that the derivation acting on a constant, on the germ of a constant function is 0, as we showed earlier, for the constant function c. And here we use the chain rule. We differentiate f with respect to the variable txi, and then we differentiate the variable txi with respect to t. And again, the bars can be written this way all over the whole thing, as we discussed earlier. multiplication and bar taking commute, because the functions that generate the germ agree on some neighborhood. And then we end up with the derivation, because this thing drops out, we end up with the derivation of that whole thing here, where from here to here, we've done two things. We changed the notation. Instead of writing those partial derivatives with respect to the ith variable, we just put this comma notation, which just makes it a little less cumbersome to write. And here we've carried out the derivative. So we differentiated txi with respect to t, and we get xi. I've also put here b and c. These are the laws that are used in these respective steps. They were annotated b and c in previous slides, in case you want to look it up exactly in the notes. So then, because of linearity, we can pull the sum out of it, and then we have the derivation acting on all of this. And the sum from I equal 1 to n is outside. And now we use the Leibniz rule. You see, we have here a function germ and there a function germ, and the derivation acts on the product of the two using the Leibniz rule. So we get two terms, one where the derivation acts on all of this, keeping that the same, but evaluated at the point P, which has coordinates 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. And another term where this all is left the same, but evaluated at the point P, and the derivation acts on that term. So here they are, the derivation acting on all of this, leaving that the same. So the derivation acting on all of this, leaving that the same, undifferentiated, but evaluated at the point P, as we discussed earlier. But the point P has coordinates 0, 0, 0, 0, which means that that's 0, and therefore the whole first line is 0. And the second term is obtained by applying, by leaving that the same and applying this here. So what do we get? Now we have that this is left alone up there, but to be evaluated at the point x equal p, which is 0, times the derivation acting on the coordinate functions, right? The xi are functions on the manifold called the coordinate functions. They map every point onto their ith coordinate. And somewhere up there is a slide in which there is a red star which explains, if you don't remember, why it is that we have to evaluate the undifferentiated functions at the point P in question. Okay, so what do we have then? this entire line goes away because that's evaluated at 0, so that all is 0. And then what we are left with is this times that. In this line, I wrote it the other way around. I wrote this here in front, and then that. Just so that we get it into a notation that looks more familiar. So what do we have? We have that the derivation, which will be our directional derivative, which is our tangent vector, acting on our function germ, gives us this expression here. It is the directional derivative, or the tangent vector, or really the derivation, it's the derivation acting on the coordinate function multiplied with this. But evaluated at the point x equal to 0. So that's the derivative here at that point, which is to be integrated from 0 to 1. But it's just a constant integrated from 0 to 1, which is the constant itself. So we get that the derivation acting on the function germ, using nothing but the definitions, gives us this expression here, which is what we were after. We wanted to show that any derivation is a directional derivative. Remember, we said earlier that any directional derivative obeys the Leibniz rule, therefore it is a derivation. Now we wanted to show that any derivation, anything that is linear and obeys the Leibniz rule, is actually a directional derivative. And that's what we see here. Because what we see here is that the derivation acting on the function germ f gives us a weighted sum, these are just numbers here, a weighted sum of the partial derivatives. Right? So any derivation gives us some coefficients multiplied with the partial derivative in the one direction, the other direction, the other direction, and so on. That is a directional derivative. These being the coefficients that point, that choose the directions, and these are the directional, the derivatives in the coordinate directions. And so we end up with a directional derivative. So what we have found in summary is that each and every derivation of the algebra of function germs, so by definition, every one of our elements of the tangent vector space, is of this form. It is a linear combination of the partial derivatives evaluated at the point P in question, where the coefficients that determine in which direction our derivation is actually differentiating, these coefficients are given by evaluating our derivation on the coordinate functions. Right? Because of this. Right? We said it is xi of xi. These are the coefficients in front of the partial derivatives. Okay, so we've seen that not only are directional derivatives derivations, because they obey the Leibniz rule, as is easy to check, but also the other way around, any linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule takes that form. And in particular, if we know how the tangent vector acts on the coordinate functions, how it differentiates the coordinate functions, then we know how it differentiates all functions, because that will give us these coefficients, and then these are just the regular directional derivatives in the coordinate directions. Okay, so here it is written up. Knowing how a derivation, that is to say, how a tangent vector acts on the coordinate functions xi, gives us the coefficients xi I. And this means we now know how xi acts on any function germ, namely through the equation 1 above. But this was still a very simple example. Our manifold was Rn. And for Rn, it was kind of overkill. We know how to write down directional derivatives. But it will still be super useful. Because just like we got a handle on what the points are of a manifold, by mapping them through a chart, by use of a chart, into Rn, so that every point of the manifold had an image in Rn, and this image had a description in terms of an n-tuple, so we had a naming for every point of the manifold, we can now try to do something very similar. Namely, we will have abstract tangent spaces for abstract manifolds, but we will try to map them somewhere where we can associate them with actual numbers, so that we can actually do calculations with them. Just like we map from an abstract manifold M into Rn, where everything is described in terms of concrete numbers, we want to do that also for the tangent spaces. And therefore, it will be very useful that we already have a complete handle on the tangent spaces in here. See, the point P is mapped by a map H into an image here in Rn. And the tangent space here, defined abstractly, as the set of derivations of the algebra of function germs will have an image over here. And the image over here will be a tangent space over a point in Rn. And the tangent spaces over points in Rn we just discussed. They are all of these tangent vectors are linear combinations of partial derivatives. They're all literally directional derivatives. And in this way, any tangent vector here can be mapped onto a tangent vector over there, and those have discrete, have concrete descriptions in terms of n-tuples. Now, this is going to be some abstract fun. That's what we are going to do now. you will see. Let us consider two differentiable manifolds, M and N. Special cases might be where N is just R, or maybe where N is M again, or maybe N is Rn. But let's, for now, leave it completely open, and we will specialize on that, on these cases later on. So we consider here a differentiable manifold M. We pick out a point P, differentiable manifold N, and the diffeomorphism phi maps the manifold into this manifold, and in particular the point P into the point Q. If, for example, we choose N to be Rn, then we would call this a chart. But not if we are mapping from M into some arbitrary N, then we wouldn't call it a chart. Okay, a chart has to be also invertible. Actually, we will always assume these things to be invertible. I mean, when it goes from the same dimension to the same dimension. Okay. Now, let us look at what is induced by this structure. So we have the differentiable manifold, and another one, and then diffeomorphism phi. So it maps in a differentiable way from these points to these points. I'm claiming that if we now look at the algebra of function germs over Q, see, at that point, we have an algebra of function germs, just a set of equivalence classes of functions, where two functions are equivalent if they agree on some neighborhood. And the same over here, we have f of p, an equivalence class of functions over there. Then, you see, because we are mapping all those points here into points over there, this induces, in a natural way, a map from the algebra of function germs over q into the algebra of function germs over p. See, this goes this way, but that thing goes that way. Why is that? Let's say we pick an element from here. What is it? It's a function germ living at the point Q. So it's basically a function on N around there, and then put a bar over it. So it's a function over this manifold N here, and the germ equivalence class that it generates. So we have a function here. It maps points of from here into R. That's what these functions do, right? A function on the manifold maps, a scalar function on the manifold maps points in here into R. What do the elements of f of p do? Well, they map a neighborhood of this into R. I'm claiming that because of phi, we have a natural map of functions over that neighborhood to functions over that neighborhood. And the way it works is this. Give me a function in here, I'll give you a function in there. Namely, give me a function in here, which is a function that takes points in here and takes them into real numbers, and I will prepend the map phi. Right? So if you have a function g, it takes as input points in here. But I make it take as input points in there by saying, pick a point in here, apply phi, and then apply g. In this way, you get a map which maps a neighborhood of these points into the real numbers. It goes this way. Pick a point, this way, and then apply g. So you get a map from this neighborhood into the real numbers. But this is the definition of what these guys are. These guys map a neighborhood of here into the real numbers. Therefore, this map induced a map from here to here. If you spell it out, it looks like this. So the f of q and f of p are the algebras of function germs. Given phi, given this differentiable map, we obtain a map phi star. That's the one that turns these functions into these functions in the following way. If we take a function g in here, it is mapped into a function f over there in this way. F is equal to g after phi. Remember the little circle there means composition. So you take first the map phi, which takes you from here into there, and then you apply the g, which takes in the real number. So overall, it's a map from here into the real numbers, and that is what the f's do. Here we had a diffeomorphism, a differentiable map. But this is not mapping a manifold into a manifold. This is an algebra. This is an associative algebra. That's an associative algebra. And what we have here is an algebra homomorphism. Algebra homomorphism means it doesn't matter whether you first multiply two elements or add two elements in here and then apply that map, or you first take the ingredients, let's say the two elements that you want to multiply, to map them individually and then multiply them. If it doesn't matter whether you first apply the rules of the algebra and then map, or first map and then apply the rules of the algebra over there, then you have a so-called algebra homomorphism, and that's what we have here. It will take a few lines to prove this, but it's just tedious. Okay, so you see they are quite different in nature. That's a diffeomorphism. That's an algebra homomorphism. And next, we will get something that goes that way again. And it's neither a different diffeomorphism nor an algebra homomorphism. It's just going to be a linear map. So how can we do that? Well, you see, if we these guys are functions on top of that space. And that's why, by composition, we got that the error reversed. If we now have something that are functions on these spaces, that map these spaces into numbers, then, again, by composition, we can now go that way. Right? So it goes this way, that way, and then this way. And we have that because the derivations do this. The directional derivatives do that. Our tangent vectors, they live on these. They feed on those. You take them as input, and output, you get the number, the directional derivative at the point P. And you see, in the same way that here the arrows were reversed going from that level to that level, now the arrows are going to be reversed again. There we go. OK, so we have the diffeomorphisms mapping the manifolds. Then at the point Q, we built this algebra of germs. At the point P, we build the algebra of germs over there. And we just discussed how that diffeomorphism induces this algebra homomorphism, simply by composition. And now we have the derivations of that algebra, the derivations of this algebra. And they, if you remember, are defined by being linear maps, which map these guys into real numbers while obeying the Leibniz rule. Now, while that map was called phi, and this one phi star, this one is called TP phi, the so-called tangent map. And it works similarly to what we had before by composition. So eta and xi, the screen doesn't show everything. Oh, actually, I can make it a little larger. Oh, view. Yeah. Okay, so now we did a map from xi into eta. This tangent map TP phi will map tangent vectors in to the point P to tangent vectors to the point Q. Okay, remember that this thing, this algebra, is associated to the point P, and the tangent space is also associated to the point P. Okay, so we need to map the xi into eta. And how can we do this? Well, so the TP maps, a TP of phi, the tangent map maps xi into eta, namely, in this way, the eta is xi after phi star. So this thing here took elements from here and mapped them into real numbers. That one takes elements from there and maps into real numbers. So we start with xi and make it into a tangent vector over there by saying, we take an element of this algebra, map it using phi star over here, and then apply xi to it. So we take phi star, which takes us this way, and then we apply xi to it, and this gives us a derivation which maps an element from here then to there. Right? So we start with xi and we get an eta. Now, the crucial special case is this. So far, we kept it completely general. This was two differentiable manifolds, M and N. Now, for the target manifold, N, let us choose Rn. And that means we can view our map phi as a chart. Okay. So if this is a manifold, abstract differentiable manifold M, this is Rn, then this diffeomorphism we can view as a chart, so that every point of the manifold gets associated to an n-tuple of numbers. And then we have this algebra homomorphism, and in particular we have this now. We have that every abstract tangent vector, namely every tangent vector that lives up here in the tangent space to P, which is difficult to give a name otherwise. I mean, you could always call it John and the other one Mary and whatever, but efficiently to label the tangent vectors in here, it's much better to map them one-to-one into tangent vectors to the point Q on Rn. And that is what this linear map now provides, the tangent map. It provides us an invertible linear map from the abstract tangent vectors on the differential manifold to the concrete tangent vectors at the point Q in Rn, of which we already proved that they are always a linear combination of the directional derivatives dx1, dx2, dx3, etc. So we know that all the tangent vectors to the point Q take the form of literal directional derivatives, which means that any vector here in the tangent space, any derivation of the algebra of germs over here, is mapped using this map here into a concrete directional derivative, which in turn is completely described by giving the coefficient numbers in front of the d by dx1, d by dx2, d by dx3. So in this way, it's like having a chart for the tangent space. A chart gives us a name for all points, and this gives us names in the form of n-tuples of all the tangent vectors.
Still induce all these maps if you don't have diffeomorphism. If you just have some smooth
Well, the term smooth is usually used to indicate that you can differentiate as many times as you want.
Yeah, but it need not be invertible map, right?
Yes. If it's not invertible, this should still work, yes. I think so. I think that this diffeomorphism will still induce an algebra homomorphism, which will still induce a linear map. I think, yes, that will still work. Mm-hmm. But we will generally, in this course, not be very concerned with how often something is differentiable. It will come up occasionally, but very rarely. We will generally assume that things are differentiable when needed. There are two reasons for that. One is that everything else would be super tedious, but also it seems to be a tremendously good description of space-time according to general relativity. So we don't really have any indication that functions that we deal with in general relativity ought to be discontinuous or not differentiable, except for cases of singularities, which we will then cover separately. I'm a bit ambivalent about this, because on one hand, we know general relativity is not the last word. Ultimately, nature doesn't work this way. It just works immensely closely like this. With tremendous accuracy, we get, for example, predictions for the inspiraling of two stars. They emit gravitational waves, and therefore they lose energy, and therefore they start spinning faster and faster, and they inspiral into each other. And that can be observed over many years, and general relativity can be used to predict how fast they lose energy, etc. And that is currently the most accurate measurement theory match in physics. It's like 15 digits behind the comma. It's because you can measure these things over years, oscillation periods that are relatively short over many, many, many years, and you can measure it with atomic clocks, so you get many, many digits behind the comma. So general relativity is enormously accurately matched with experiments. And yet, because of quantum theory, we don't believe it's the final word. So what do we do about it? On one hand, this mathematical description is extremely successful, but not the final word. So it would be good to always keep in mind the limitations of this. Something is wrong with all of this. We just don't know yet what it is.
So basically, if my row can be infinitely differentiable, but it's just not invertible map, all this construction just falls. Just
I think it does, yes. Yes, because remember, we never used invertibility here.
Okay.
We do want invertibility if this is to be a chart. But if you just have m to n, then not. You see, if you don't have invertibility, in the case where this is Rn, you cannot use it as a chart, because many points here could be mapped into one point over there. So that wouldn't be good as a chart. It would be a coordinate system where for one coordinate, you could have two different events, or many different events. That wouldn't work as a chart. And of course, these things do happen. Sometimes you have non-invertibility for obvious reasons. Like if this n is just r, if it's just r, then you're dealing with functions from m into r. So you're just dealing with scalar functions. But you can still carry that through. All right, so we have a tangent map. And now we're looking at the crucial special case where we have Rn, and if it's invertible, then that would be a chart. And in this case, we have that phi star, the map between the function germs, is not just an algebra homomorphism. Algebra homomorphism means it doesn't, if you remember, it means it doesn't matter whether you first do an algebra multiplication or addition, and then map, or you first map the ingredients and then multiply or add them. No, it's more than that. It's also an algebra isomorphism. And in that case, when the phi is invertible, then TP phi is a vector space isomorphism. So in this case, where we're dealing with a charge, so it's a diffeomorphism that is invertible, then the algebra homomorphism is an isomorphism, and the linear map is an invertible linear map. It's a bijection. And in particular, any abstract tangent vector in here now has an image over here, which we can use to denote what we mean over there, just like we use coordinates to denote points over there. So just like under a chart, every abstract point P in the manifold has a concrete image phi of P in Rn. We now have that every abstract tangent vector xi in the tangent space to the manifold at the point P has a concrete image eta in the tangent space to the image of the point P in Rn. And that image eta, which is in a tangent vector to the point, that shouldn't be P, that should be phi of P over here in the tangent point, I call it concrete. Because as we calculated tediously earlier, all of those eta can be written explicitly because they are tangent vectors to a point in Rn, can be written explicitly as linear combinations of partial derivatives in the xi directions. So literally directional derivatives. We showed that every eta is of this form here. And therefore, once we fix the diffeomorphism phi, we have that every set of numbers eta here not only determines a tangent vector to the point that we mapped on in Rn, but because it's an isomorphism, it also denotes an abstract tangent vector in the manifold M to the tangent vector to the point P. So conversely, assuming a fixed charge phi, any choice of points q denotes a point p in the manifold, and any choice of coefficients for a directional derivative eta at the point q in Rn, any such choice of tangent vector there denotes a choice of tangent vector in the abstract manifold, in the tangent space to the point P on the abstract manifold M. And so eta, in particular, these partial derivatives here, these directional derivatives in the coordinate directions, are the image of some abstract derivations of the algebra of germs, are the image of some abstract tangent vectors on the abstract manifold. And sometimes it will be convenient to blur the line between the left and the right in this business here. And instead of, and you're all used to this already, it's just worth spelling it out. In principle, we should always be aware that when we write down a point here with coordinates q1 to qn, and we say that's an event in space-time. But it's not. It's a point in Rn. It's just the image of an event in our space-time manifold. And similarly, when we write down a tangent vector here as a particular directional derivative with coefficients eta 1 to eta n, then we can say this is a tangent vector to our space-time. It's not. It's actually the image under that map of a tangent vector that lives in here. But for short, it's just so convenient to just speak of the chart as being given. We assume, yeah, OK, we work in a chart. But then apart from that little subtlety that we are using a chart to map things, we will just say these coordinates xn are an event in the manifold. These coefficients eta of a directional derivative determine a tangent vector. But really, of course, they are only under the tangent map. OK, and of course, if we then change chart, not only will the coordinates change, but also the tangent map will change. And that's fundamentally the reason why these representations then change. This is why a tangent vector changes its coefficients when we change chart. It's the same tangent vector, of course. It's the same derivation of the algebra of function germs on the abstract manifold. But two different charts give us two different images with two different coefficients. But behind the scenes, the abstract thing is always the same. And traditionally, in Einstein's days, the method for identifying what a tangent vector is was to say tangent vector is an n-tuple of numbers associated to a point which transforms in a particular way, which changes its coefficients in a particular way when you change chart, when you change coordinate systems. And that's what we will do next time. That would be a quick thing. And then we will also do the geometric definition of the tangent vector, the tangent space, and that will be also relatively quick. So this was the algebraic definition of tangent vector space. And one of the things that you please take away from this is that we identified derivations of an algebra. That was very useful. And we will use that over and over again to define all sorts of derivatives, Lie derivatives and covariant derivatives. All of those things, almost all of them, are derivations of an algebra and can be defined in very similar ways to this. So we'll get used to this notion of derivations of an algebra. OK? See you on Friday.